If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Friday, April the 24th, and welcome to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen, a Hoover Research Fellow and the Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Fellow in Journalism. My guest today, coming to you via Skype from what I'm assuming is a warm and sunny Southern California, is my colleague Leo Hanian. Lee is a Hoover Institution Senior Fellow and a Professor of Economics and Research and Director of the Edinger Family Program in Macroeconomic Research at UCLA. He's also the Associate Director of the Center for the Advanced Study in Economic Efficiency at Arizona State University and a Research Associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research, where he co-directs the research initiative Macroeconomics Across Time and Space. Lee, welcome back to the podcast. It's been a week.
Hi, Bill. Yes, it is. It is. Every week is what a week now.
I'm reminded of a Ronald Reagan story when he's elected governor of California, and he's taking the oath in January of 1967. And his aides discover that Pat Brown, who's the outgoing governor, is appointing people left and right before he leaves office. So the Reagan's folks decide that rather than wait until that morning to do the inauguration, they're going to do it after the stroke of midnight. And Reagan, ever the showman and one-liner artist, takes the oath, and then he turns to George Murphy, at the time a U.S. senator, and you Hollywood fans might remember George Murphy as a song and dance man and an actor who showed up on TV like Reagan a lot. And Reagan turns to Murphy and he goes, "Well, George, here we are again on The Late Show."
Oh, my goodness. Yes, Governor Reagan, President Reagan, never at loss for words.
Yes. So here we are, Lee, a week after we last talked. And the news this week in California, probably Wednesday, Governor Newsom doing his press conference, at which time he would not offer a reopening date or a time for when he might revisit the stay-at-home order. But he did tell the public that essential surgeries could resume. So that's your news nugget this week. This raises a lot of questions we're going to get into. What you're seeing across the country now is fissures developing with states. In Georgia, for example, Governor Brian Kemp is allowing some businesses to open today on what he calls a limited basis. And these are gyms, hair salons, theaters in Georgia, Lee, are going to start opening up on Monday, subject to some restrictions. Restaurants will open up, but dine-in customers are going to have to obey distancing orders. You look across the country, Lee, and you're seeing push coming to shove here in the next few days. A lot of states have April 30th deadlines for stay-at-home. They're going to have to reconsider whether to extend or not. These are states like Arizona, Texas, South Carolina, the list goes on. Too many to read here. Michigan, for example. Some other states, Lee, have windows that are further pushed out into the middle of May. Virginia extends its stay-at-home all the way to June the 10th. South Dakota, by the way, does not have a stay-at-home order. But there are four states in the country who do not have a target date right now. One's on the East Coast, Maryland. But the other three are the regional states here on the West Coast, Lee, California, Oregon, and Washington. And I think, and I want you to comment on this, I think what we're seeing is a new divide in American government. And it's not Republican, Democratic, or red, blue, or left, right, as we're accustomed to, Lee, but I think it's science and economics. You have some governors who are deferring to scientists and public health officials, and other governors who are feeling economic pressure. Now, you follow California's economy on an excruciatingly close basis. Is this what the governor is doing? He's basically deferring to science instead of economics.
Bill, I think he is. And the difficult issue that he faces and all politicians face, all governors face, is that science is very fluid. It's evolving so quickly. It's gone from an estimate of a coronavirus fatality rate that was as high as 3% just 5 weeks ago, perhaps even just a month ago, which is an extremely high fatality rate. And today, most estimates for the corona fatality rate are much lower than that. Some estimates are as low as 0.3%, so a factor of 10 different than the fatality rate estimate was 4 or 5 weeks ago. Right. And as the science changes, it really impacts the trade-off, the economic trade-off that all these governors face between the race of protecting their populace versus taking just day after day of enormous economic hits on their budget, and people out of work, and business owners who are not able to run their businesses. And Americans are absolutely wonderful people who are willing to sacrifice enormous amounts for legitimate emergencies. I mean, you look at what our fathers and mothers and grandfathers and grandmothers did during World War II. An important reason why we won the war is because Americans were so remarkably, they went three levels up in confronting that emergency. Now people are starting to question whether it is truly an emergency. They are questioning, well, if the fatality rate is only slightly higher than the flu, and we never really bat an eye about the flu, why are we forcing all of us to stay home? So this is really it's a difficult governing issue. It's a difficult scientific issue. But every day this goes on, people are getting more and more restless, and understandably so. And the costs are rising at the state level, the costs are rising at the national level. This is really a one-off. It is unprecedented. It is an economic slash scientific slash cultural, you know, explosion that you and I and everyone is watching from front stage. And in some ways it's fascinating, in some ways it's excruciating because it's so costly. And I think within another couple of weeks, I think we'll have a lot more clarity, certainly in terms of the science, and certainly in terms of states and governors being able to say, such as here in California, we just economically cannot sustain this much longer.
Right. So, Lee, as of yesterday, now we're doing this podcast late in the morning on Friday, so Governor Newsom, about an hour from now, will probably have updated numbers. But as of Thursday, the 23rd, California reported 37,800 cases of coronavirus, Lee. To put that in a statewide perspective, if the state population is about 40 million people, 1% of the California population is 400,000 people. So we're talking right now about 0.1% of the population that's affected, 1,440 deaths. Here is one thing I'd like to find out, Lee, from the 1,440 people who've died from this or related to this, and you know, several thousand others who are in the hospital. I'd like to know a few things. I'd like to know this according to age groups. I'd like to know it also according to pre-existing conditions. I'll give you a good example. Big news here in the Stanford campus. Donald Kennedy, a former Stanford president, passed away. Big headlines. He died from coronavirus. He did have coronavirus. He also was 88 years old. He had suffered a massive stroke about 2 years ago and is obviously in a very, very weak condition. So I'm very curious, Lee, and this is going to tie into the economics of the situation. We have to break down who gets this and how you're affected. If you are 35 or 40 years old and healthy, does this kill you? Does this strike you down? Or is this going to strike down mostly older people who are infirmed? I think that's one of the questions moving forward. And what it leads to, Lee, is this great question of what is acceptable risk in our society.
Bill, that's really the key question, the key issue. And because coronavirus, or at least this strain of coronavirus, is only about 3 or 4 months old, scientists and virologists are learning more and more about it. But it's a weird virus in that it is not like the flu, where if you're exposed to influenza, chances are you get it. It's extremely unpleasant. Relatively few people, other than the youngest and the oldest, die from the flu. But the weirdness of this version of corona is that so many people are simply asymptomatic. I mean, their immune systems are able to fight off the virus without even a sore throat or without even fatigue, without even a stuffy nose. And an important reason why the fatality rate has been downward estimated by a factor of 10, from 3% fatality rate to 0.3% fatality rate, is because we're finding out so many more people are testing positive that their bodies are producing antibodies to the virus. In New York, it's estimated that as many as 22% in Manhattan have been exposed to the virus. So that's why we're finding out that the fatality rate is so much lower. And Bill, you're absolutely right. Fatalities are striking the oldest people in society, those in particular with diabetes and high blood pressure and cardiopulmonary issues. And virtually every economist I know now is coming up with the identical policy, which is those who are at high risk, which are those perhaps who are 75, those who are perhaps over 50 and who have diabetes or hypertension or congestive heart disease, they should be protected. But the 25 and 35 and 45 and 50-year-old folks who are healthy should absolutely go back to work. And an important side benefit of this is that most of them who are exposed to the virus will develop immunity. And as society develops much more immunity, coronavirus will become much less of an issue. So I suspect that many more people in California have probably been exposed, have not shown symptoms. And in terms of your really good question about acceptable risk, what we know about America is that 2 years ago, by definition, we were willing to accept as many as 100,000 influenza deaths just two winters ago. No one really batted an eye. We demonstrated we were willing to accept that many fatalities from the flu. If that means we're willing to accept that many fatalities from the flu, it means that we're willing to accept some fatalities from corona. And the reason is because we can't stop them all. It is physically impossible to stop them all, and it becomes just incredibly expensive, much for the same reason that we probably could build an airliner that would be fail-safe at some level, but we don't do it because we don't think the risk-return trade-off merits that. So that very much is the issue confronting all of society, including the governors, and I suspect we're going to be transiting in that direction within the next 2 to 3 weeks, that we will get businesses back on, we will get workers back, and this will primarily be younger, middle-aged people and those without pre-existing conditions that we know are associated with serious corona-type disease.
Let me ask you another risk-related question, Lee. The All England Lawn Tennis Club, known better the world as Wimbledon, it spends about $2 million a year on pandemic insurance. It's been doing it for the last 17 years, and this year, Lee, it paid out. They're getting $141 million on their insurance policy because they've been preparing for this for 17 years. Here's my question, Lee, as you study the California economy in this very, I find, very disturbing question of what the legislature is going to do in reaction to this. Do you think it's possible that we might see a change in how business is done in California in this regard, Lee? Right now, if you set up a business in California, you have to have workers' comp insurance. More companies are taking on cyber liability insurance in case they get hacked.
Yes.
Companies have general liability insurance. Do you think lawmakers are going to require California businesses to have pandemic insurance? And to flesh out even further, Lee, if you're going to do pandemic insurance, why not earthquake insurance right now, which is optional? It's a separate insurance policy. In other words, mandates.
Yes. Well, if there's a requirement that can be imposed upon business, and there in some universe is some half-baked reason that someone can come up with to fool themselves that it's required, it will be imposed by our wonderful state legislature. So, you know, God love them. I understand that their heart's in the right place, but they do not necessarily think about this from a cost-benefit perspective. So that's a great question. I could certainly see them coming up with the idea of pandemic insurance. And I think it's fascinating that they haven't come up with requiring earthquake insurance. And of course, the more mandates we impose upon business, the cost of business goes up. We cannot hold a gun to a restaurant owner's head and say, stay open and serve hamburgers for $3.99 and take a loss of $5 in every burger. So if we do that, we will continue to lose businesses to other states. And our long-term record of losing businesses is not a good one. We lost Bank of America. We lost Wells Fargo. We've lost Nestle's. Nestle's is a Swiss company, but its American headquarters were in Glendale. They're gone. Toyota was gone. Toyota's gone now. California, as we talked about before, California just continues to get closer and closer to squeezing the neck of the golden goose so much that at one point the golden goose is going to stop laying those golden eggs that have been the hallmark of California's economy for a century. It's for you and I have lived here a long time. It's very sad to see that because it is such a remarkably wonderful state with so much accomplished and so much more potential to accomplish here in the future.
Let's talk about your California on Your Mind column. California cannot sustain depression 2.0 much longer. And for our listeners, Lee and I write columns under a web channel called California on Your Mind. Lee writes on Tuesdays on economics and policy. I write on Thursdays on policy and politics. You can find it at the hoover.org website. I recommend you read it. Lee, you use the word depression, and my eyes went straight to that word because having been in California for 25 years now, I'm very used to the word recession. I came here during one in 1994, saw another one after the dot-com bubble burst in the early 2000s, saw another one under Arnold Schwarzenegger, but you used the D word, depression. I went and did a little homework, by the way, on the 30s depression in California, Lee. Unemployment reaching 28% in 1932. By 1934, one-fifth of all Californians were dependent upon public relief. And also, Lee, a tremendous amount of social upheaval, the deportation of Filipinos, repatriation of Mexicans, the so-called repatriados. Woody Guthrie came up with a wonderful, clever song called Do Re Mi. Let me read you a few of the lyrics because they actually apply to modern-day California. His song goes as follows. California is a Garden of Eden, a paradise to live in or see. But believe it or not, you won't find it so hot if you ain't got no do re mi.
Woody nailed that.
He did, but depression 2.0, why did you use the D word, Lee?
Yeah, so I use the D word because as an economist, I often think about what distinguishes a depression from a recession by the size of unemployment. And we've had over 3 million California workers file for unemployment over the last 5 to 6 weeks. If we add those 3.2 million Californians who have just filed for employment, along with the existing stock of about 750,000 Californians who are unemployed previously, we get up close to 4 million unemployed. Within a labor force of about 20 million or so, which means that unemployment in California is right around 20%. So I often think about 15 to 20% is the dividing line between a recession and a depression. And right. Bill, you're absolutely right. California never has a mild recession. It's always much more severe than the recessions of the rest of the country, which is something else I went into in this column.
I'm guessing that's because, well, first of all, to back up a second, so the Great Recession, the one that Jerry Brown walked into in 2011, unemployment peaked, Lee, at about 13%, I believe?
Yes, exactly, about 13% in California, which was above the national level, which was just under 10. If you take California out of that calculation, then the rest of the country was probably about 9.5% versus 13% in California.
Right. So the question of why California has such deep recessions, I think the answer is pretty obvious. It's our tax system, right?
Exactly. California, every time the country catches a cold, California shoots itself in the foot with this just an extraordinarily badly designed tax system. The best tax systems are ones, in setting aside the idea that legislators make sensible decisions about how to use the revenue, but they are tax systems that are efficient. By efficiency, I mean that they tax a stable source of revenue, and the taxes don't grossly distort people's economic decisions. California taxes an incredibly unstable revenue source, and it's unstable because the taxes that we impose grossly distort and change people's economic decisions. So what I mean by that is California depends on income taxes much more so than any other state. And in addition, we depend on that reviled top 1%. So in California, the top 1% pay just over 50% of state income taxes compared to about 34% in the rest of the country. And in California, at least, the top 1% are very good at finding ways to reduce income declarations during downturns. So, for example, capital gains in California are taxed at just regular income tax rates, which now are as high as 13.3%.
Right.
What you and I remember is the old temporary millionaires tax imposed in, I believe, 10 or 11 as a way to 2012 to keep the state's K-12 funding from just dropping through the floor and to maintain some level of education system. And of course in 16, that temporary tax was, you know, CalSTRS was made permanent. So now we have a situation where capital gains are realized when the economy is doing well, when share prices are high. But during recession, stock market goes in the tank, and guess what? People are not realizing capital gains. Right. So we just see this enormous revenue roller coaster. And I'll offer this one statistic to listeners, which I find which really sums up the entire California fiscal situation. In the Great Recession, so in 10-11, 93% of the drop in California income tax revenue came solely from households declaring $200,000 in adjusted gross income or higher. So just that very small group of taxpayers, those households with $200,000 of income or more, AGI, was responsible for 93%. Of the $20 billion drop in tax revenue that occurred in 2010. That simply is a recipe for disaster when we get into a downturn, which is when state spending has to go up in terms of safety net programs. And that's why in fiscal year 2010, even though state GDP dropped only about 2%, tax revenue dropped 20%, a factor of 10 larger. And that simply is not a fiscal structure that makes any sense, and it just exacerbates the degree of recession. It makes life just so much harder than it has to be here.
Right, Lee, there's another driver that's been affected here, and that's real estate. This is the spring in California. This is the busiest time for real estate transactions in this state. And it's a difficult time to sell properties, in part because people don't have money, people are reluctant to part with money. And then you just think, Lee, about the physical weirdness of trying to sell a house and having people come into your house and look at your house. They can't touch anything. Maybe you don't want strangers to come in. So it just further complicates the economic situation for this state. So you're right, we have to fix the tax situation. I want to now jump into my California into my column, and I should probably apologize first, Lee. I swim a lot, or at least I used to swim when pools were open. And when you swim laps, you notice that there are people who understand the idea of staying in their lane, and then there are other people that kind of like they're kind of like drivers who kind of go over the stripe and you have to honk to keep them across. There are the people who kind of swim into your lane, and yeah, I did a little bit of this to you this past week, my friend. My column was entitled "California Cannot." My column was entitled. I wrote about the California Task Force, and I'm sorry, I'm trying to find my column here right now. Mine was, is the script for California's economic recovery already written? And my column was quasi-economically, but mostly political. Here's what I was after. Governor Newsom, last week, we talked about this on the podcast, he announced a task force on business and jobs recovery. That's the good news. He's looking at recovery, but here's where it quickly becomes problematic. There are 82 non-political appointees on this task force, Lee, 82, not 10, not 15, but 82. That's not accounting the 11 political appointees, state lawmakers, past and present. It is vintage Gavin Newsom in that it has a splashy headline. He has Tim Cook from Apple and Bob Iger, the former Disney CEO, involved. But here's where the problems kick in, Lee. First of all, the co-chair of the task force is Tom Steyer. What do we know about Tom Steyer? Tom Steyer has spent an astounding amount of money. He spent $250 million running for president briefly in 2020. Tom Steyer comes fully equipped with an agenda, which is green energy and a lot of political correctness, slavery, reparation, things like that. So he is your task force co-chair. You look into the 82 non-political appointees, Lee. I counted them, 12 represent unions or laborers. And then what I find kind of bothersome, Lee, is who got left out. So you mentioned Wells Fargo, for example. Big banks are not to be found on this group. Speaking of green energy, fossil fuels, there's no oil representation. And then the gig economy, which is one of your favorite hobby horses. There is a company called TaskRabbit, which is on the panel. They do sort of temporary labor, day jobs for communities. But the big boys aren't anywhere to be found, i.e. Uber and Lyft. This, to me, this is why I did the headline, is the script already written, Lee. I think you know where this is going. It's going to be more Green New Deal, higher taxes, more government regulations and mandates. And I just wonder, what is the governor thinking? Is this the way to go about an economic recovery?
All I could think of when I saw the list of 82 non-political appointees to a committee that's tasked with the incredibly important job of how do we get the economy restarted after dealing with this one-off viral epidemic is Gavin's primary, I'm sorry, I'm speaking slowly here because I still can't believe it. Is his primary goal here simply to be so politically payoff and inclusive that he's already running for the 2024 presidency? And the idea that, you know, so the idea that a committee with 80 some odd plus, you know, 95 members can get anything done is laughable. Even if one split it into 10 subcommittees, that would be nine plus person committees, which again is, you know, all of us, including listeners, have served on committees. You know, once you get past about four people, it becomes very, very difficult. And the idea that finance, fossil fuels, and big gig economy businesses such as Uber and Lyft, the idea of leaving them off is just, I don't know what he's thinking there. Leaving off big banks is incredibly central for funding not just businesses, but residential lending. Right. Leaving off fossil fuel is incredibly important for, obviously, you know, producing electricity. So who is included? And as, and Bill, as you mentioned, whatever, I believe there were about 10 appointments from organized labor. So who's included and who's just very noticeably left off is just blatant in front of our eyes. And you're absolutely right. This is going to be more greenness, which means higher costs, which means lower efficiency. And again, very ironically, for what is a state that's controlled by a single party. And not to be partisan here, but we know that among the very wealthy people, folks in the Democratic Party, they can afford to pay Green New Deal programs and they can afford new taxes. For millions of people who are just barely making it in California, who are paying 50% of their income on rent, this is just going to be enough to tip them over and tip them into, guess what, homelessness. So ironically, the party of the people is one that's going to be incredibly punitive to the people as we go forward in the next few months and as California moves out of Corona and California, in the words of Nancy Pelosi, you know, becomes not only the greenest state in the country, but becomes even greener. And isn't that a wonderful thing? That's what it's going to be about, Bill. And I just feel awful because I mean, sitting here in late April, I can just imagine, man. I look around the state and I see people just barely making it, but they're in an apartment. And some of those people, perhaps 1 out of 10, 2 out of 10, 3 out of 10, are going to be out of that apartment 3 or 4 or 5 months from now. And it's I can't imagine just a sadder thing, because there's nothing you or I can do about this other than try to get the message out that what the direction the state's heading in is one in which it's not a political issue. It's one that is all about the safety and the harmony and some semblance of prosperity for people who live here. And a smaller and smaller group of people are able to enjoy that.
Now, the good news here, Lee, if you want to be cynical about this, is the history of task forces in state government is not a very pretty one. The Parsky Commission, which Arnold Schwarzenegger and the legislature came up with over a decade ago, formerly the Commission on the 21st Century Economy. Two of your Hoover senior fellow economists, Michael Boskin and John Kogan, served on that. This was a very manageable commission, Lee. It was 12 members. It was divided in terms of conservative and liberal outlook. Nobody really with an agenda at the table, mostly academics and people with government experience. In other words, you didn't have, for example, as on this task force, the California Teachers Association involved, or somebody who's doing contracts with state government. So it was more academic in that regard. They came up with a plan for revamping California's tax system, and guess what? Just went straight into the trash can in Sacramento. If you want to go back in the 1960s, I believe Pat Brown came up with a commission to look at Los Angeles and California after the Watts riots, and it came up with a lot of ideas such as after-school programs and so forth, and that went largely ignored as well. So maybe we're being a little alarmist about the task force, but if the legislature does take recommendations from the task force and puts them into play, number one, they'll pass. The governor will sign them, I assume. And then I think two things are going to happen, Lee. Number one, businesses will start thinking again about the jobs climate, because coinciding with this will be the run against Prop 13 this fall, the rewrite of the Prop 13 measure revisiting business property taxes in California, Lee. There will be a run on income taxes in 2022 to raise the personal income rate up to 15%. Businesses just might say, time to start going. And what I'll also predict, Lee, is when we can resume airline traffic, you will see the states of Nevada and Arizona and Utah, every state with a much lower tax system, they'll do what they did in the 1990s. They'll come here and they'll have job fairs. And they'll say, you know what? If your business wants to leave and go to Nevada, come on over. We're open for business.
So come on over, yeah.
That's the challenge facing California. It delights Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to do more green energy stuff, but there is a consequence. The consequence is going to be one of economic growth in the state.
The consequence is exactly economic growth in the state. And what never really gets discussed within the media is that this is all feel good about California being the greenest state and the idea of it becoming even greener. And the reason I say it's feel good rather than having any substantive impact is that this green issue about climate change and carbon emissions is a global issue. And California is responsible for something like 0.4% of carbon emissions, of global carbon emissions. So we could literally bankrupt the state and make everything renewable, and we would reduce carbon emissions by about 0.4%. So this is not a win situation for us, other than making some constituencies feel good about themselves, being able to go to bed at night and say, gosh, isn't it great that we just force every new home in California to have solar panels? Isn't that just a great idea, when that is about the most inefficient? So California really has lost track of the vision it once had, which was, and just to borrow from your earlier phrase, stay in your lane. Government exists here to make California a safe place, a fair place for people to live and to do business and to provide quality education and to keep people safe. And that's really what the purview of government is. Government does not exist here to try to deal with global problems that it has no control whatsoever over. So we've gone off track in California. And as a person, who was born in California, who grew up in California in the 1970s, and I've lived here after coming back from being a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, being back here for the last 21 years, it's discouraging to see every year on average that things get worse here for the average family. And so, Bill, all I can hope for is that this committee gets so bogged down it doesn't do much. And when you mentioned that Michael Boskin and John Kogan were part of that small committee a number of years ago, there was so much good about that committee in the sense that it was focused on how to create government integration with business and with individuals and households for the 21st century economy, which was an economy that California was so important in terms of technological innovations and Google and Apple. But instead, as you noted, that was not a partisan document. A lot of good suggestions came up from that. Michael and John are absolutely splendid economists, and there were other outstanding scholars on that commission. But as you noted, it went right in the Rand file. So all we can hope for is the same thing happen. I hate to say that, but all I can hope for is the same thing happens now.
Okay, final topic, Lee. Brian Dahl is a Republican state senator from northernmost California, and he has a plan for reopening, and he thinks it should be done regionally. Now, he's being very, very parochially because he represents 11 Northern California very rural counties. He represents Alpine, Lassen, Modoc, Pluma, Sierra, Siskiyou counties. They each have had less than 5 confirmed cases of COVID-19, Lee. This is as of April the 20th. So he's begging the question, why can't my counties reopen? But let me put this to you, Lee. Can California, can its economy operate if, say, the rural northernmost part is open for business? Agriculture goes on, you know, timber, things like that, they're open. But you shut down San Francisco, you shut down Los Angeles. Does it have to be, can you do parts of the sum, or does it have to be the sum of the parts?
Well, Bill, that's a great question. And I think the senator's right to be questioning why those areas are locked down. There is no particular compelling scientific reason to do that. But by the same token, just so much economic activity is generated within 20 miles of the coast that, you know, we could go ahead and get those areas. We could get farming back. We could get lumber back, timber. We could get those less densely populated counties back and going. Which I think would be terrific, but that's not going to solve our economic woes. It really is going to be about opening up Los Angeles, San Francisco, Silicon Valley, San Diego, Orange County.
You know, Lee, I wonder if Tim Draper has taken note of this. And who is Tim Draper? A very bright venture capitalist here in Silicon Valley, and the man who has tried several times to break up California. I think his latest plan, Lee, which he tried to get on the ballot, the Three Californias initiative. So maybe Draper is going to look at this and think, you know, maybe it's time to start thinking about breaking up the nation state.
You know, and interesting enough, Bill, that idea just keeps popping up every half decade or every decade. And, you know, people look at California and just think, you know, that what the state with just so many natural gifts. There's so many people who live outside of California who deep in their heart wish they could live here. They don't really want to live with the California government we have, but they wish they could live here. And yet they're looking at us and just saying, why can't those people be happy and coexist? Well, you know, you and I know why that is the case, because we have a government that's no longer really focused on making what I would say sensible decisions. And I think sadly we have coastal California is doing for the most part well. And when I say well, it means unemployment is low. Incomes are relatively high. On the other hand, the cost of living is extraordinarily high along the coast of California. And then you go into Merced and Stockton and Madera and Fresno, and they're still struggling just in terms of recovering from the last recession. And now we're hitting them again with another. So yes, California's big. It's 40 million people. And it really is a state that has so many different constituencies. So, so I think Draper is going to look at this and say, yeah, let's give this another shot. And, he probably won't be successful, but there's just that underlying current of discontent that continues to flow through the state. And it doesn't have to be that way. It just doesn't. With just a few more sensible decisions in terms of how we spend, how we tax, the size of government, the priorities that we place on what public issues should be addressed and those that perhaps aren't so high priority, this could be just the state that I knew as a kid growing up in the 1960s and 1970s, when it seemed like literally for me and the friends I had as kids, every day seemed like anything was possible in California. And now I look at kids and I just think, they're just going to struggle to live here, or they'll probably have to move somewhere else.
So Lee, we may be doing this podcast every Friday until this situation resolves itself. So I hate to break it to you. You may be stuck with me for a while. but assuming we do this next Friday, is there any economic news you would like to point people to next week? A couple of things come to mind. I think Apple has an earnings report coming up in the next few days. And also the end of the month is coming. So that means EDD, which collects unemployment data for the state, they should probably have a jobs number coming out too.
Exactly. That's going to be the big one. As I say, I think we're in unemployment territory. There's somewhere between 15 to 20%, perhaps even higher. And so the EDD report is going to be the big one. And obviously, Apple's earnings report will be significant as well. And then people should be looking at Newsom's daily press conferences to see if he's giving any type of inkling whatsoever about trying to reopen with a focus on getting young and middle-aged healthy people back out there, and then really focusing, quarantining, and supporting those who are really just in the high-risk category. So I suspect we're not going to see that this coming week, but if we do, I think that would be a very good sign.
So circle April 30th on your calendar, because I think on that day, Lee, a lot of states around the country are going to extend their stay-at-homes for maybe a couple more weeks, maybe a month or so. And I think the press are going to have a lot of questions for the governor about, you know, when is the target date for us? So I would look for that next Thursday.
Exactly. And that implicitly puts more pressure on California, depending upon how states are going to be responding to that.
Okay. Lee, you stay safe, but, you know, I have only so much pity for you. You're living down in Santa Barbara, and anybody who's been to Santa Barbara always begs one question. Why would you want to live anywhere else?
You know, yes. If we have to be under house arrest, it's a pretty good place to be. And Bill, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for having me, and you and yours stay safe as well.
Thank you, Leo. Talk to you next week.
Sounds great. Looking forward to it.
You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States, and since we're talking about California, the 40th Governor of the great state of California, Gavin Newsom. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes. And if you wouldn't mind, please spread the word, get your friends to have a listen. Also, by the way, give us feedback if you want to hear this every week and if you have California topics you want to get into. The Hoover Institution is online at www.hoover.org. While you're there, do yourself a favor and sign up for Hoover's Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Lee Ohanian and his Hoover colleagues to your inbox every weekday. And that includes California On Your Mind. As I told you earlier, Lee writes on Tuesdays, I write on Thursdays. By all means, check it out. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst. That's @HooverInst. Lee Ohanian is on Twitter. His Twitter handle is @Lee_Ohanian, and Ohanian is spelled Ohanian. @Lee_Ohanian. I'm on Twitter. My Twitter handle is @HooverWhalen. Whalen spelled Whalen. For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Until then, take care, stay safe, stay strong, stay healthy. Thanks for listening. Talk to you soon.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work, and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.